Yep.
Good. So welcome to the third session of the presentations. To the left here is David Clyde, a member of the Marxist Humanist organization, and he's the author of The Philosophical Roots of Anti-Capitalism, which was published in the US. And his next book will be Helen McFerlin, Red Republican, complete selection of writing. So, just hand it over to you then.
Thanks. Okay, I'm going to talk about Alfred Sloan Weil. And the title of this book is, which is out in hardback in the United States, to all intents and purposes, unavailable over here. The clue to my talk is in the title of this book, The Philosophical Roots of Anti-Capitalism. It's, in itself, that's a critique of Sloan Weil, because he certainly didn't believe that there are any philosophical roots to anti-capitalism. I'll start with some biographical background. Alfred Sloan Weil was born in Germany in 1899, and he lived until 1990. He was a student in Heidelberg, and in his teenage years, he became associated with a number of intellectuals who later became leaders of the Frankfurt School, in particular Walter Benjamin, Max Horkheimer, Theodor Adorno. And in 1931, because of the slump, he couldn't find employment in the academy, so he got a job in the offices of the Industrial Employers Organization in Berlin. So when the Nazis took over in 1933, he found himself with access to a whole load of secret information, and he effectively became a spy for the anti-Nazi underground, and he was very effective at this to all accounts. He had a whole load of information on the economic shenanigans of the Nazis in the first years of the Nazi regime, and he passed this information to the, like I say, to the underground, and he seems to have screwed up the Nazis pretty nicely until 1937, when someone tipped him off that the Gestapo were about to arrest him. So he got out of Germany fast and came to England. Now, arriving in England, he went to Oxford and he was reunited with Theodor Adorno, and he had some long meetings with Adorno, and they discussed a manuscript he was writing, which eventually became his major work, Intellectual in Manual Labour. Now, Sloan Weil was developing the thesis that the exchange of commodity values as mediated by money was a precondition of the objective process of abstraction, which was in turn the precondition of abstract conceptual thought. And Adorno found this notion very impressive, and he wrote to Max Horkheimer suggesting that Sloan Weil might be given a research project with the Frankfurt School. in New York. Horkheimer. Was of the opinion that philosophical categories were primarily conditioned not by exchange abstraction, but by the social conditions of labour. So he was slightly sceptical of Sohn Rettel's thesis. And he said that, he wrote the Sohn Rettel and said, if the connections he was making between ideological and economic structures was more than just analogies, then it would need to be worked out more conclusively. So, to cut a long story short, Sohn Rettel was in London. He was working as a foreign language teacher. He waited for the call from the Frankfurt School, and the call never came. So that's as far as Sohn Rettel got with the Frankfurt School. But apart from meeting Adorno, he also met an English member of the Communist Party. Well, actually, he was Irish. George Thompson. And he found that George Thompson was researching similar things to Sohn Rettel, except that George Thompson was engaged in historical studies of ancient Greece, in Sohn Rettel was engaged in philosophical research into Kantian categories, which I'll say a bit more about later. So, I'll come back to this. I must continue with the biographical information. In 1951, Sohn Rettel completed his book, the first draft of his book, Intellectual in Manual Labour, and he submitted it to the publishing house of the British Communist Party, Lawrence and Wishart, with the blessing of George Thompson. And the CP rejected it because they were worried about its non-orthodox nature. He then submitted the manuscript to bourgeois publishing houses. They rejected it because most of them were like, you know, this was the height of the Cold War. They weren't going to publish stuff written by a supporter of the Communist Party. So, in Intellectual and Manual Labour, Sohn Rettel comments on Marx's speculation in the critique of the Gotha programme about the vanishing of the antithesis between mental and physical labour in the higher phase of a socialist communist society. And Sohn Rettel writes, but before understanding how this antithesis can be removed, it is necessary to understand why it arose in the first place. He argues that in order to derive consciousness historically from social being, we must presuppose a process of abstraction which is part of that social being. In commodity exchange, the abstraction of the action of exchange cannot be known by the participants when it happens, because they are occupied with the use of the commodities they see in their imagination. Sohn Rettel grounds the emergence of Western philosophy and scientific thought in an autonomous intellect, which becomes separated from manual labour and production in civilizations of antiquity. These civilizations are formulated as, firstly, societies of appropriation, and secondly, communal societies, which are societies of production. So a society of production is primitive communism and modern socialism. A society of appropriation is a society of slavery, as you had in ancient Greece, or feudalism, or capitalism. So, let's say a bit about George Thompson. George Thompson and Sun Wrestle became very close. They were both supporters of the Communist Party. And Sun Wrestle says about Thompson, "He was the only man I have known who had also recognized the interconnection between philosophy and money, though in a completely different field from my own." Sun Wrestle and Thompson were each in their own way attempting to analyze abstract schemes of production as constituted by historical forms of social synthesis. Thompson, in his book on Greek antiquity, sees the social synthesis as involving the development and expansion of metalworking, agriculture, military conquest, chattel slavery, and most importantly, coined money as currency. So jump forward a bit. George Thompson is working on Greek antiquity. Sun Wrestle is working on Kant. Sun Wrestle says that Kant breaks open the particular epistemological riddle of exact science, how non-empirical concepts can bear the necessary reference to nature. Kant, in grappling with the rational metaphysics of the 18th century, was, as is well known, shaken from his slumbers by David Hume's attack on metaphysics. And Hume's critique of metaphysics is accepted by Kant as the decisive refutation of the idea that universal forms and categories of reason can be grounded by means of inductive logic in the external world as experienced through the senses. But Kant then turns the tables on the empiricists with his arguments that universal categories are a priori to sensuous experience. Kant's critique of pure reason explains that in our perception of phenomena, we find various contents, some experienced as external, some as internal. All of these experiences are subjective, but within them, Kant finds a universal element, an a priori other, which consists of the intuited, sensible forms of space and time. The categories of the understanding, including causality, universality, and substantiality, are likewise a priori products of the universalizing mental structure. Although we are conscious of being determined by things happening outside of us, the pure abstract principles of space and time enable us to perceive objects as separate from one another and events as succeeding one another. The a priori categories of transcendental logic enable us to make judgments about what is perceived. Although it's transcendental, Kant's philosophy is not transcendent. Kant does not think that a philosophy can transcend its own sphere to show the true reality of things, the thing in itself. Since scientific knowledge depends on concepts a priori not depicting nature as it really is, we can only understand nature as it corresponds to the concepts. Reason is regulative, not constitutive. the understanding orders the objects as concepts and gives them unity so they can be applied practically. In Soren Rittel's interpretation, the nature from which the non-empirical categories of intellectual labor are drawn are not the primary nature of the physical reality, but the second purely social nature. In effect, Kant isolates that part of our being which can perform in separation from manual labor. Okay, now I come to the question of the commodity, which is where my differences with Soren Rittel begin. According to the English philosopher Julian Rose, on the mature writings of Marx in Capital, the theory of commodity fetishism is the most speculative moment in Marx's exposition of Capital. It comes nearest to demonstrating in the historically specific case of commodity-producing society how substance is misrepresented as subject, how necessary illusion arises out of productive activity. Now, in contrast to this view of a commodity-producing society as historically specific to capitalism, Soren Rittel, in his essay, The Historical Materialist Theory of Knowledge, quotes George Thompson and agrees with him when Thompson says, civilized thought has been dominated from the earliest times down to the present day by what Marx called the fetishism of commodities. That is, the false consciousness generated by the social relations of commodity production. In early Greek philosophy, we see this false consciousness gradually emerging and imposing on the world categories of thought derived from commodity production, as though these categories belonged not to society, but to nature. Thus, in the Soren Rittel-Thompson thesis, the categories of Greek philosophy are seen as emerging from a commodity fetishism which is equated with the false consciousness or practical solipsism generated by money-mediated exchange. Now, although Soren Rittel recognizes that human labor has gone, the human labor that has gone into the productions of the commodities determines the magnitude of their value, he argues, quote, this abstraction does not spring from labor, but from exchange as a particular mode of social interrelationship. And it is through exchange that the abstraction imparts itself to labor, making it abstract human labor. End of quote. The fact that commodity exchange existed in activity, however, does not mean that the false consciousness arising from it was universally fetishistic in anything like the modern sense. Now, when Soren Rittel makes this distinguished, he equates these societies of production, primitive communism and modern socialism, is determined by the production process. And he sees societies of appropriation, Greek antiquity, Roman slavery, feudalism, capitalism, as determined by the exchange mechanism. And there's no doubt that he wasn't a simple-minded Stalinist. He was doubtly highly critical of the divisions and inequalities in the so-called socialist economies between mental and manual workers. And note his insistence that to the conditions of a classless society, we must add, in agreement with Marx, the unity of mental and manual labor, or as he puts it, the disappearance of their division. End of quote. Unfortunately, this goal is never grounded in Solon Rettel's critique. His statement to the effect that the struggle against the division between intellectual and manual labour had, quote, formed a central issue in the construction of socialism in China since the victory of the proletarian cultural revolution, unquote, betrays a Kantian dualism between ought and is, if not a lapse into Maoist voluntarism. That is not to say that Solon Rettel's ideas can be simply reduced to Stalinist Diamet or Maoism. His materialism differentiates itself from communist orthodoxy by asserting that the reality Marx opposes to consciousness is not matter, but social existence. I quote from Solon Rettel again. The reality, then, to which Marx critically opposes the various forms of consciousness of men is the historical one of their own social existence. It is not matter or the external material world independent of consciousness. Our notions of things and the concepts in which we undertake their systematization are historical products themselves. So are science, mathematics, natural philosophy. It is for the historical materialist to account for the rise as well as the objective validity of science in history, but not for the logic of natural science as a logic reflected from nature to supply the principles of historical materialism. I should point out that all these quotes I'm giving you from Solon Rettel, they need some thinking about. You know, you have to ponder on them for a while. So I must apologize for that, but I'll continue. In the historical materialist theory of knowledge, Solon Rettel notes that categories such as substance, being, magnitude, abstract time and space, and uniform movement are similar to the principles of being discussed in Engels and Edurin. And I better quote from Engels here. Engels asks, whence does thought obtain these principles? And he answers, from itself? No. The realm of pure thought is limited to logical schemata, but what we are dealing with here are forms of being, of the external world, and these forms can never be created or derived by thought out of itself, but only from the external world. But with this, the whole relationship is inverted. The principles are not the starting point of investigation, but its final result. They are not applied to nature and human history, but are abstracted from them. It is not nature in the realm of humanity which conform to these principles, but the principles are only valid insofar as they are in conformity with nature and history. This is the only materialist conception of the matter. End of quote. Solon Rettel points out that Engels' formulations are further developed by Lenin for his theory of reflection in materialism and empirical criticism. Solon Rettel concedes that there seems to be at first sight a certain incompatibility between his own view that the basic principles of knowledge can be traced to a root in social existence and the view that they can be derived from the external world by way of abstraction and reflection. In proposing a reconciliation, Solon Rettel argues that he is opposing the idealism of the Kantian transcendental synthesis by means of a materialist critique of epistemology. But his methodological postulate nevertheless employs a neo-Kantian form. Having presupposed the object of his critique, a form of objectively deceptive universal logic locked into the false consciousness of timelessness, He then seeks to discover the conditions of its possibility in the social synthesis established in the ancient world through exchange value facilitated by coined money. Because his solution involves a methodological postulate, it needs to be compared with the use of postulate in Kantian and neo-Kantian method. In Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, objective validity is restricted to the conditions of the possibility of objects of experience through appearances, and more generally, the conditions of all knowledge of objects. Empirical knowledge is made possible in the synthesis of perceptions and objects of experience with general a priori rules. Neo-Kantian sociology seeks to develop a scientific method for investigating the sphere of moral facts and values, the objective validity of which is conferred by the power of society and culture. However, a sociological a priori, unlike Kant's transcendental unity of apperception, is external to the mind, and therefore has an object-like causal relationship to thinking. Emil Durkheim, seeking to discover the social conditions of the possibility of actual experience in human communities and of their objective validity, locates the origin of moral and coercive force in collective consciousness or collective being, acting as a sui generis, underivable, transcendent objectivity. But because of its transcendent and underivable nature, this condition cannot be a fact itself. Therefore, it is like God or freedom in Kant's Practical Reason, which is introduced to make morality intelligible, a postulate. The difference, as Gillian Rose points out, is that for Kant, the postulate is only regulative, whereas for Durkheim and the Neo-Kantians, it is constitutive. The similarity is that in both cases, the postulates, on the one hand God for Kant and collective consciousness for Durkheim, are what make social experience possible or intelligible, even though what is postulated in both cases remains unknowable and unanalyzable. Gillian Rose argues that once the social origin of the categories is admitted, it becomes impossible to explain the relation between the unconditioned and conditioned without using the very categories of the conditioned, such as cause and effect, which need to be justified by the precondition. So the question is, does Sohn Rethel's methodological postulate escape the horns of this apparently logical dilemma? As we have seen, Sohn Rethel seeks to replace the Kantian transcendental unity of consciousness with his methodological postulate of the social synthesis brought about by commodity exchange, of which the objectively false consciousness of idealist philosophical thinking is a reflex or projection. In reference to the historical developments in Greek antiquity, Sohn Rethel highlights the triumph of the ideology of philosophical idealism in class struggle against what he calls a scientific form of materialism representative of the primitive artisans of the lower orders. Sohn Rethel and George Thompson believed that early Greek science had already established the categories of analysis, such as cause and effect. Therefore, if this assessment of a putative materialism in pre-Socratic thought rendered dormant until its a renovation by Marxist materialism, if this is sound, then the apparent incompatibility between Sohn-Rettel's tracing of the basic principles of knowledge to a root in social existence and Engels' deriving of the principles from the external world by way of abstraction and reflection would seem to be overcome. However, the reconciliation between his methodological postulate and Engelsian reflection theory rests, in my opinion, on a questionable historical validation. What Richard Seaford, who I also write about, we can go into him if you like, what Richard Seaford discerns in the work of Thompson as a tendency towards reductionism and dogmatism can be seen in Thompson's attempt not only to divide Greek philosophy into materialism and idealism in the tradition of Engels, but also to reduce the divide between idealism and materialism to contending social classes in ancient Greece. Now, according to Thompson's colleague, who was also an Irish member of the CP, a chap called Benjamin Farrington, whose writings on Greece are quoted favorably and at length by Sohn-Rettel, a secular scientific movement began in 6th century BC in ancient Greece, beginning with Thales, then Anaximander, then Epicurus. This movement offered a general explanation of nature without invoking the aid of any power outside of nature. Farrington claims that the atomistic philosophy of Epicurus was scientifically true, potentially useful for material progress, and philanthropic as a popular philosophy. Farrington asserts that the kind of things that Anaximander was saying in his book on nature were the same kind of things that an up-to-date writer puts forward today, this is the 1930s, in a scientific handbook on the universe, and that Anaximander drew his conclusions about the universe from observation and reflection. Okay, now I should point out that Thompson's tutor at, I think it was Cambridge, I always mix up the two, Oxbridge, that's all the same to me, was a chap called Francis MacDonald Cornford, born 1873, died in 1941. He was a Fabian socialist, and he was a classical scholar, and he taught Thompson, and he taught him quite a lot, in fact. And when Thompson started publishing his books, Cornford was pretty horrified at what he was coming up with. Cornford argued in 1912 in his book From Religion to Philosophy that although the early philosophers structured their abstract schemes of conception on the basis of intuitive certainties of geometry, they were not, as some have imagined, scientists in the modern sense of the word, i.e., they were not dispassionate observers taking in and explaining sensory data with theoretical hypotheses. And Cornford wrote an essay which is a critique of Thompson in Farrington, which is basically completely forgotten, called The Marxist View of Ancient Greece, in which Cornford poses the following question on Farrington's claims that Anaximander was writing in a way which some kind of, in some way kind of prefigured a modern scientific textbook. Cornford asks, what kind of observation could have taught Anaximander that the Earth is a cylindrical drum, three times as broad as it is high, or that the fixed stars, the moon, the sun, in that order, are respectively distant from the Earth by 9, 18, and 27 times the diameter of the Earth. End of quote. Cornford goes on to challenge found in Thomson's view of a materialism as frowned upon by the ruling class of ancient Greece as subversive. Cornford writes, I venture to say that no spectator listening to Prometheus's recital of the arts bestowed on man to alleviate his miserable condition could possibly have associated these arts with the atomic theory or any other Ionian system. Prometheus is called by Mr. Thomson the patron saint of the proletariat, and the proletariat of antiquity were, he tells us, the slave population. But it was not an audience of slaves or of workers or of peasants that met in the house of the wealthy Callias to hear the great sophists Protagoras, Hippias, and Prodicus. Farrington argues that the primitive materialism was the emancipatory ideology of the little people in their struggle against the idealism of Plato, who wished to deny them access to truth and poison their minds with outworn superstitions. Thomson, for his part, claims that following the Peloponnesian War, Athenian thought was divided between those who supported the city-state, who were rich, such as Plato, and those who were prepared to see it fall, who were not rich. Cornford comments, the implication that the abolition of the city-state would have entailed the abolition of social inequalities, including slavery, is hard to justify in the light of history. So to finally return to Sun Rebel's divide between the logic of a society of appropriation and the logic of a society of production. He says that the logic of appropriation cannot change into a logic of production until desocialized labor is re-socialized and people create their own society as producers. The problem, it seems to me, is that he thinks that the only thing preventing social labor from becoming directly socialized is the exchange relation. A society is potentially classless when it acquires the form of its synthesis directly for the process of production and not through exchange-mediated appropriation. As Moishe Postol has observed, the mode of societalization affected by industrial labor is positively evaluated by Sun Rebel as non-capitalist and opposed to the mode affected by exchange, which is assessed as the essence of capitalism. Postone sees in this claim the mistake of restricting abstraction to a market phenomenon completely extrinsic to labor and capitalism. To restrict the value form to the abstraction in exchange is to ignore abstract labor as forming the basis for alienated social structures. So now I come to my conclusion. As Rosa Luxemburg said, at the moment the Greeks entered history, their situation was that of a disintegrated primitive communism. In that case, communism made its first appearance in philosophy amongst the elite of Plato's Republic at the very time it was being extinguished in its primitive form throughout the Greek world. The advent of coined money in antiquity as real abstraction undoubtedly influenced the formulations of the philosophers, but so also did changes in class relationships, social practices, and beliefs. In a more modern context, I've argued that arguments relating to the roles of money, exchange value in capital, to Kant's transcendental synthesis and to Hegel's self-synthesizing absolutes. But why should the importance of the Hegelian dialectic, which Sohnwessel dismisses because it's idealist, why should the importance of the Hegelian dialectic for interpreting Marx's critique of capitalism be restricted to consideration of Hegel's logic as expressing the self-movement of the logic of capital, as some modern theorists like Chris Arthur argue, or I'll also discuss in this book. Hegel's logic, even as it represents the logic of capital, is like all of his philosophy, imbued with an absolute negativity, which can be read as anticipating Marx's critique of capital, in which the logic of his system intimates a realm beyond it, i.e. communism. The claim that Hegel's philosophy is obsolete apart from its logical method, blocks investigation into the relatively unexplored relation between Marx's concerns with theorizing an alternative to capitalism and the absolute negativity of Hegel's concept of freedom expressed in such works as The Phenomenology of Spirit and The Philosophy of Spirit. How long have I been going for?
3 quarters.
Okay, that's enough.
There's an essay about origins of abstract thought by either Lafargue or Mehring, I think, that was published by Newmark in the 1970s. It's in their collection. And I think he says he perceives an origin of abstract thought in feudal society. I don't know why. But I like the argument that Thompson's thing can't work, because I can remember picking them up and reading them. This is really good, but can't be true. You know, it's a bit difficult because the play was at Silvermine, and it seems to have yielded interest as well, apart from which it seems extraordinary. But there you go. But so much of the life of the Greeks wasn't under market relations at all, which I think is Marx's argument, isn't it? When he says why Aristotle couldn't get abstract labour, he says that the society just wasn't sufficiently developed for him to understand the abstraction of exchange, because I think Aristotle says exchange is impossible, more or less. He says that how can it take place, because how could the labour of the sophist possibly be compared to the labour of the horse thief or whatever. I don't know what I'm asking exactly. But would you say, is it implied in what you're saying that there are other bases of abstract thought? Or maybe you just don't need to say what the bases of abstract thought are? You know, like, there are good people, there's good arguments saying, you know, do we have to give a social account of the origins of thought? And is that kind of a reductive operation anyway? I mean, I've read good accounts of trigonometry as being to do with marking out fields, which seems reasonable to me. And I could imagine lots of practical technical tasks demanding, you know, abstract or measurement, and all those things were confronted, which don't necessarily have anything to do with exchange process. But I wonder if there needs to be a kind of, does abstract thought need to be justified in that way?
Well, I actually talk about this a bit in the book. And to be fair, Soren Rattle talks about it as well. You can trace real abstract thought back to ancient Egypt. That's when the power of numbers is first exercised. I mean, Egypt is obviously a society of appropriation, but it's one society, the way he expresses it. You've got this ruling class of Egypt, and you've got this Stone Age peasant society, which is essentially collective. And the ruling class of Egypt appropriates the surplus from the collective society. And although their thought is completely irrational, you know, their religion is, you know, totally bonkers. The way they organise the irrigation of the land is entirely rational and uses geometry and numbers. So that is kind of the origin of autonomous, you know, ruling class thought. And then that kind of gets picked up by the Greeks. And in what's new about the Greeks, well, one of the things that is new about the Greeks is that they start coining money. Now, that's obviously very important, because if you go back to, like, as really early philosophers like Parmenides, he talks about the one, you know, it's this whole problem of the one and the many, you know. And you've got this universal one, which is imperishable, and you've got these perishable things that, you know, come in and out of being, you know, they pass in and out of it. And Thompson and Soren Rattle make a very interesting point that, you know, the oneness of, I mean, you can't make sense of Parmenides' philosophy on its own terms. You have to ask, why does he think this? You know, that's the only rational question. You know, gold coins represent the universal oneness, and the things that you can buy with coins are the perishable many. Yeah. And another person I discuss in the book is a present day classicist called Richard Seaford, and he says, he quite likes, you know, Thompson, he even likes Farrington, who strikes me as being a real crude dogmatist. But Seaford makes a point that there are kind of other things happening as well in Greece. And one of the things he points to is that one of the collective practices that remain in force, like you mentioned, the silver mines. You know, what happens to the silver? Yeah. And what happens to the iron? And Seaford has this fascinating thesis which relates to communal feasting in religious sanctuaries, where the religious organization organizes these big feasts where everyone has an equal portion of roast meat, which is something of a luxury. So you have these festivals. So people bring things along in order to become part of this religious feasting, and they bring along metal figurines of the sacred animals, the bulls or the cockerels or whatever, and also bring along metal roasting spits, which are standardized, they're all the same size, and because they're made of metal, they have some value, so they can be exchanged. So Seaford speculates that the standardization of precious metal objects, once the silver mines really get going, someone has a bright idea of, let's stick a stamp on the metal, which has got the stamp of the local tyrant on it, which indicates that the metal contains a certain amount of precious metal, and you can exchange it. So Seaford, in my opinion, has made a real breakthrough. He's rooted the development of coined money not only in this tyrannical practices, but also in this kind of which is why I refer to Luxembourg, this kind of disintegrating communal forms. Yeah. And so the it's not just money, it's also related to people's relationship with the organization of the church. They want to feel one with the church. And Seaford also relates it to these religious cults that are around, such as the Dionysians and the Orphics, and this need for people to, you can say today, the need for people to feel part of an organization, to be part of a community. So and that's why I think Luxembourg's onto something when she says that she's actually arguing against Engels to a certain extent. As soon as the Greeks enter the scene, what are you looking at? You're looking at a society of either disintegrating or disintegrated communism.
Which you mean by the feasting? The feasting is the communism, but it's got these elements that are taken up in tyrannical coining.
Yeah, because once a coin starts, the tyrants start hoarding the coins and they pay the mercenaries, right, to do bad things. So then you get imperialism, etc. You get, and as Aristotle points out, he says a city state. He says two things about the city state: it must not get too big, and it must not have massive inequalities of wealth, because if it gets them, it's going to start to break up. Yeah.
So you're coming back a bit to Thompson, if you're finding...
I think Thompson's really important.
Primitive capitalist social relations in ancient Greece.
Yeah, I just think Because I think if Thompson hadn't been affiliated with, you know, the CP, in its most, you know, dogmatic period, when, you know, he wouldn't have made so many mistakes as he did. And you know, because he eventually became a Maoist, you know.
Oh, yeah. What was he called? A five? I can't remember. The something publishing house. Studies or something. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right.
I came a bit late, but my question is, could you say something more about Marx's immanent critique of private property and abstract labor? Because you were speaking about the Hegel's negativity, approach of negativity, and like how Marx's conception of communism results from Hegel's like idea of immanent critique, or I just know the German word, bestimmte Negation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so could you probably say something more about this problem of immanent critique of private property and abstract labor? Because Marx even starts to speaks about this problem in the manuscripts already, 1844.
Yeah.
In his critique of the other socialist movements and ideas. So yeah, could you somehow say something more about this?
Yeah, well, we've been studying, me and Luke have been, we've just been reading Marx's 1844 manuscripts. And he's quite scathing about the communists of his time. He says that he attacks them for wanting to, you know, level things out. And he attacks them for wanting to establish what they call a community of women, where, you know, women just become kind of, like at the this kind of universal prostitution. And he also talks about that as the way that the communists of his time talk. They want to level things down so much that it will actually prevent any kind of original thinking. Yeah. So he talks about alienated labour, and he says, and I think he largely gets this from Hegel, because although he hadn't read Hegel's early writings on industrial labour, where Hegel is like very, very critical of factory work, he thinks it's you know, dehumanising, and it just creates this kind of rabble, yeah. And he's afraid of the rabble, yeah, because Hegel. He's got his, although I kind of love Hegel, he's got his historical limitations. He didn't live in a time where you had any kind of organized working class, or where you had any kind of socialist ideas impregnated in the working class. But Marx did. By 1844, he's been getting reports from England, from Engels, about the Chartist movement. He's just come back from Paris, where he's been talking with the French workers who are interested in communist ideas. So Marx makes this point about alienated labour. He says, first of all, as a worker is alienated from the goods he or she produces, because the worker produces value that is then expropriated by the capitalist. Secondly, the worker is alienated from the actual work process itself. It becomes a kind of hateful, harmful process that the worker can't wait to escape from, as you know, as soon as the clock sounds. And thirdly, because labour is kind of desocialised, people are individualised and they're alienated from the totality of the species being. Yeah. So, so Marx is trying to understand this, and in the way this relates to Hegel, as I see it, is that Hegel regards himself as the modern day Aristotle. You know, that's quite clear. And Aristotle conceives of a society where you've got, at the top you've got, you know, theoreticians, and in the middle you've got this world of what he calls praxis, of, you know, the citizens. And at the bottom you've got production, which is largely carried out by slaves. And the realm of freedom is the realm of praxis and the realm of theory. And the realm of production is not a realm of freedom at all. And Hegel is looking at modern society and he's saying, you know, how can we be free? And Hegel has a lot of allusions in English political economy and the work process. He thinks that you can have a fair market. You know, he thinks the French Revolution has made, you know, great strides towards this. In some ways, Hegel is, you know, the philosophical equivalent of Adam Smith. And he sees that the difference between a modern society and an ancient society is that in an ancient society, what one's being is determines one's work. So if you're born into a certain, you know, area, a certain class, a certain sphere, that's going to determine what your work is. You know, whether you're a philosopher or a milkmaid or a blacksmith. But in a capitalist society, that situation is reversed. What you are is determined by what, largely by your work. I mean, you can see it with the attack on the unemployed at the moment. You know, if you don't have a job, you're worthless. You're scum. Yeah, you're there to be sorted out. You know, in the United States, they're talking about the for minority communities, they're talking about the school to prison pipeline. So, so Hegel is concerned with all this stuff, but he can only solve it philosophically. And Marx tries to move the whole thing away from philosophy and develop, and the way he does this is to develop a critique of political economy and, you know, work out the laws of production of capital. And just as Hegel's absolutes intimate this kind of possibility of a totality, a Marxist critique of capital intimates a beyond of still communism.
So for Marx, of course, for Marx, capitalism is the precondition for communism, of course.
Yeah, it has to be, yeah.
Yeah, it has to be, but my question is, like, in which sense? Because, of course, private property cannot be abolished in the way, like, the other communists, like, Proudhon or other communists wanted to do it. So it's like that dialectical move to, like, somehow keep private property, but not under conditions of capital accumulation of profit.
Oh, I would say that Marx agrees with the old communists that you do need to get rid of private property and the market, and you need to get rid of commodity.
Private property in the means of production.
Pardon?
Yeah,
that's
not to nationalise your toothbrush.
No, but you do want to break the mechanism of capital accumulation. No, you don't want to, nationalise every hamburger stall, as someone sets up on a Sunday afternoon.
So it's about the difference between, as you said, private property of the means of production and private property, or like personal property. I don't know what the English word would be.
Personal property,
because
yeah.
Because in the manifesto he also speaks about this difference.
Yeah.
That the communists, they don't want to abolish personal property, but they want to, of course, abolish capital as a form of private property of the means of production.
Yeah.
So, but I think this is like a very important, like, this is like the main point of like Marx's critique. So, and I sometimes have the feeling that this point.
So, Marx's critique of the tradition of the the true socialists.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think that this point is like very crucial, so I think it's important to like try to elaborate this problem like more, or like try to understand what this actually means.
I said, yeah, I agree. That needs to be worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crucial, yeah. Exactly what would it mean to break with capitalism without making the mistake of going back to the old forms? The working class, no one is ever going to be persuaded to go back to Stalinism, and the conditions for social democracy no longer exist. So we have to be looking at something new. And that can't be answered in the abstract. It has to be. Address all of the social movements. The impasse of the modern labour movement. What's gone wrong? Lots of questions. Can it be revived? Is the left dead? Yeah, there you go.
Would you see your work as a contribution to that project?
I hope so.
I maybe have a question that kind of touches base on this. I'm trying to phrase it. So you said that. Maybe you could go into like this, Horkheim's critique was of Zonretto, his critique. So on the one hand, I was thinking like that, and maybe I just like got like the point about Zonretto wrong that you were presenting, but like that Marx really emphasizes that like the structure or like the basis of like the social constitutionalizing the like conditions of production, right? And so and then here I mean about Sonnet, you said that like the it is about like the money exchange process that then like influences like the objective abstraction, which leads back to like philosophical categories. Mm-hmm. I mean, would that be like shifting Marx's problem from production to exchange? And would that mean then that like the categorization of like societies, as you said, like kind of like primitive society, and then like and then you have like enter a phase of like just like exchange societies from like Greece till like the advent of, let's say, like modern communist society. Is that like a different categorization than like Marx would see? And then maybe the question would be like, does that mean that like the logic of exchange itself, like when like primitive society disintegrates, does that mean that like exchange itself like creates a logic that in a sense like is expanding and leads to like a kind of modern day like industrial society? Or in other words, like why is it like for Marx possible to have an insight in like the nature of society like in the moment of the Industrial Revolution and not like Hegel, for example, just like 40 years earlier? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense to me.
Well, Marx says at one point, he says that you know, alienated labour isn't produced by exchange and commodity production. It's actually the other way around. That if you have a society of alienated labour, you have to have like the exchange mechanisms in some form. And I didn't go into the question of Russian state capitalism, but you could say that the fact that, you know, Stalinism's attempts to suppress the market without actually abolishing alienated labour was precisely what, you know, led to its failure. I think Postone would agree with that. But there was another point you made that I'm trying to think what it was.
The
Horkheimer's critique
of Sonnet.
Oh, right.
The question of production and exchange.
I only mentioned Horkheimer in passing to explain why Sonnet was excluded from the Frankfurt School. I'm not qualified to talk about Horkheimer. Adorno maybe, but not Horkheimer. It was basically Adorno who was Sonnet's, you know, big buddy. When Adorno met him, he was astounded by, you know, the originality of his insights into the relationship between Kantian dualism, you know, the separation from mental and manual labour, and capitalism. Someone could probably write a fairly good article or even a book actually examining how much Adorno took from Sonnet, but I haven't done it.
Coming back,
your turn.
Yeah, coming back to the title of Sonnet's main work,
Intellectual and Manual Labour.
Yeah, one of the features of capitalism today is that the manual labour aspect is being continually reduced and eliminated from mm-hmm. the system, and more people, wage labourers, are doing forms of intellectual labour, mm-hmm. usually in front of a screen of some kind. What changes do you think that means for the abstract labour and for the Sonnet of thesis?
And what, in more to the point, what what does it mean for Marx?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes.
Because that was quite central to the critique of the Goethe program. That he said that, you know, at the higher stage of communism, the division between mental and manual labour would break down. And clearly, the division between mental and manual labour has characterised all class societies. I don't know, but I think what you can say is that there is a hell of a divide in the left between intellectuals and workers. You know, a friend of mine, Peter Hudis, he went to China. And he was speaking to some students, he was giving a lecture. And he mentioned, you know, Marx's thing about the breakdown of mental and manual labour. And the way the Chinese students saw it, they saw it in terms of the Cultural Revolution, yeah? Because that was the propaganda of the Cultural Revolution, you know, smash the division between mental and manual labour. And it had the horrific consequences of the Cultural Revolution. So, I think the point is that although a lot of people are working with their brains now instead of their hands, it's still pretty crap work. It's still drudgery. And even the more creative, traditionally creative professions are becoming more and more drudge-like, you know, more and more box-ticking, you know, in universities and, you know, the power of numbers seems to be asserting itself more and more. I guess we're looking at a future that we can't see, you know, that's, because we're so fucking alienated, you know, where it's very hard to see the future. Which is why our critique is necessarily negative. Although, at the end of the day, we have to get beyond the negativity into, like, some kind of, you know, positive way forward for humanity.
And then, lastly, looking at the thesis as put forward by Son Rethel that you've critiqued, and also Jeremy Richard Seifert's work, do you think that a case can still be made out for the social basis for abstract thought?
I think abstract thinking is inevitable, but if it's embedded in you know, the social division of labour, then it's not a good thing. It needs to be transcended. Our whole idea of socialism is abstract. It needs to be concretized. Which, you know, brings me back to the problem the left's got of the left is basically middle class. An intellectual, and the working class is somewhere else, in as much as the working class still exists. I think it does, but not in the same way as you know, people used to think. And in the positive sense, I think the decline of the left, in the rejection of the left by workers, isn't such a bad thing because the workers are behaving rationally. They know crap solutions when they see it. Yeah. It's a positive thing. That they don't buy the old left arguments. It's a good thing. It's a challenge for us, a hell of a challenge. James.
Two things that were coming up, sorry, these are like odd comments. One is on the Horkheimer and Songrattle. I'm not sure now after what you just said, but I would have thought Songrattle had more time for abstract thought, as it were. Whereas in Eclipse of Reason, Horkheimer is quite savagely critical. I mean, he's still there in Dialectic of Enlightenment. I mean, to say that there's a thing in Horkheimer and Adorno where their instrumental reason is like, you know, from the moment the first guy picks up the first, you know, that's, we're all off to hell in a handcart. You're thinking, well, don't pick it up, mate. There is a kind of, you know, they associate rationality itself with, or it comes close in Horkheimer in The Eclipse of Reason to associating rationality with irrationality. It's very confusing. It's set lectures around the same time, presumably were influenced by this correspondence, I would guess. And my memory's bad, but I thought Songrattle wasn't saying that abstract thought was a disaster or a problem. He was saying it was a good thing, but it was problematic. So I would have thought that we haven't yet laid a proper foundation for it. I don't know if that's true. Then the other thing I was thinking, I like Robin's argument because it kind of suggests maybe that the division of mental and manual was itself not a very good description because it kind of rests in the use value producing element, in the concrete labour element. It's not really a class distinction. It maps onto a class distinction, and it certainly did much more in Hegel's time and in Marx's time. The guys with the pencils were middle managers. They weren't, Hegel had it the wrong way around, didn't he? The thinking people were actually servants of the really powerful people. But so it would have mapped onto a kind of a sociology, but it does so less and less. Even the most manual labour has got an intellectual component. The most mental labour has got a kind of mechanical aspect. You know, even if you're doing footnotes, that can be a pretty mechanical operation. So maybe it's not a good foundation. It was doing more work than it had to do.
Well, it certainly came unstuck in Songrattle's hands. I was thinking that the way to go was a great Chinese proletarian cultural revolution.
We could all wear that's his cap.
That was in Adorno's terms, the great proletarian cultural revolution was an example of false immediacy.
False immediacy, yeah. Very good. Yeah. Yeah. Of course, you know, Hegel writes in the Phenomenology about the lordship, about the lord and bondsman, where the bondsman does all the work, and the lord does fuck all. But the lord becomes stupid, and the bondsman becomes clever.
Yeah, but people often don't remember, but the lord still remains the lord.
Oh, yeah,
at the
indeed,
end of that
indeed.
Story.
Yeah, let's not forget that.
That's an interestingly different account, isn't it? Because it's not exchange that gives rise to spiritual distinction between thought and being.
No.
It's honour or courage or to believe that your honourable existence is more valuable than your physical existence.
Yeah.
So it's entirely out of violence, comes out of abstract thought, out of violence.
But it,
that's
get, it gets resolved the way Hegel resolves it. I mean, Kojève is totally wrong to think it's like the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, according to Gillian Rose. What actually happens is that the thing gets resolved in the bourgeois law, you know, the law into the market. Yeah.
Oh, so the market is, yeah, of course, the market is the resolution. It yeah. makes it all rational. So yeah. we can manage it. But that's like Benjamin Constant. And, you know, there's an idea of civil freedom and natural freedom. Natural freedom is barbaric aggression. Uh-huh. You know, like an ape is free or a caveman is free.
Uh-huh.
Whereas civil freedom is the same spirit managed, isn't it? So Hegel's market as a resolution of the martial spirit of the combatants.
Mm-hmm.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
I don't really believe it was a free market in ancient Greece. What happened to those 300,000 or so years in between?
Oh, it got feudalism. First the Romans.
I don't think it was ever meant that there was a free market. There was a limited market.
Yeah.
And that's why they needed the silver anyway. And of course, slaves were one of the most important
chattels
marketed items. And silver was used for buying slaves.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you didn't have... You know, the penetration of commodity production.
No, you had the domestic economy for most consumption goods, of course.
Yeah.
As Aristotle describes, his book on economics is actually what we would call domestic economy, how to run a farm.
I've actually got the quote from Marx on Aristotle. And Marx says, Aristotle himself tells us what prevented any further analysis? The concept of value. What is the homogeneous element, i.e., the common substance which the house represents from the point of view of the bed, in the value expression of the bed, for the bed? For the thing in truth cannot exist for Aristotle. And he goes on, the secret of the expression of value, namely the quality and equivalence of all kinds of labour, because and insofar as they are human labour in general, could not be deciphered until the concept of human equality had already acquired the permanence of a fixed popular opinion. This, however, only becomes possible in a society where the commodity form is a universal form of the product of labour, hence the dominant social a relation in the relation between men as possessors of commodities.
Okay. Any final remarks?
No, I think we're done.
Okay.
Thanks very much.